If you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
Mama, wie fühlt sich die große Liebe an?
Süß, zart und so cremig.
Hä? Wie kann denn Papa cremig sein?
Nutella wurde von Mama schon vor Papa geliebt. Nur Nutella ist Nutella.
Hello and welcome to Empire with me, Anita Arnon.
And me, William Drimple.
This is all very exciting and cozy, isn't it? Look at us all in one place together. I will be punching you at some point. Because you're here.
I'm within punching distance.
You're in the kill zone. Listen, we are joined today, we're very thrilled by this, by Peter Moore, the author of Endeavour. And if you listen to our slavery series, you will know, because I have banged on about this quite a lot, that Francis Barber, that episode, Peter, that we did with you, was absolutely one of my favourites. But we're here today because it's part of our Christmas. Please tell me you know this Christmas carol, I Saw Three Ships Come Sailing. Do you know that one?
I do, but not well enough to sing it.
You're not going to sing,
no.
Peter?
No, but if you want to have a go.
Solo baritone.
I tell you, a few shanties later on maybe. Well,
it
was a thing. I said, look, Christmas, we'll do Three Ships, the history of three ships. And everyone looked at me like, huh? It's what? We know Away in the Manger, but you know it. That's great. So you're one of our great ships, and the ship that you've written about, which William, it now says that he said to me before we started, please leave room for me fanboying. So Endeavour, which is such a great story.
Just have to say that this is one of my all-time favourite history books, and I read it over a very, very nice family holiday in Goa with the sea crashing on the kind of beach, on the kind of the dark volcanic stone of the beach below with palm trees. And it was the perfect place to read this great book. And occasionally, our regular listeners will know that I do recommend a book above all books. This is one of those.
I mean, he says recommend. He means rave obsessively about. And yours has been one of those books.
But this is an extraordinary book. And I just also, as someone writing narrative history and biography, I've learned a lot of how to do it. It's a book by an author who's clearly got completely obsessed by the subject and lost himself in the rabbit hole of the Endeavour and all the archives and the business of how you build a ship and the creak of the timbers and the splash of the waves on the outside and the barrier reef. And it's one of the great reads and particularly good for Christmas time. So just me doing my little sales pitch. I'm done.
You're done? We're past this now.
I might have an outbreak again later on.
That's fine. We're quite prepared. But for those who don't know, I mean, the Endeavour was a research vessel at the time of Enlightenment, and the name that is inextricably linked and why the timbers of this ship are so important is James Cook. Tell us a bit more about that.
I'll leave Cook to one side for a moment because I think the ship is my central area of focus. And
you
I start with the acorn.
It literally starts with the little... Let him talk.
It's
such a clever idea.
So my big top line for you is my claim. I do not know whatever ships you picked for your series of ships. My ship, I will make a case for being the most important ship in the history of British exploration, which is...
And it's fighting words, Peter, I'm just saying, but carry on. Yeah.
No, so we can interrogate that later on. Endeavour...
Beagle being presumably quite a runner-up.
Particularly known for this one voyage, which happened between 1768 and 1771, which was the first of Cook's big three voyages into the South Seas, which was a period name for the Pacific Ocean, we call it today. Darwin later said that Cook single-handedly added a hemisphere to the known world. Now, that's Victorian discovery narrative. Well, now we look at things quite differently. We look at things from a multiplicity of viewpoints, and Cook is obviously a big participant in this. And let me tell you about the book and where the book came from in a structural sense. I was interested, my mother comes from the North Yorkshire coast, and I'd known about Cook all my life. And I'd read a lot of biographies of him, and I was always intrigued by a line in the histories. And the narrative line always followed Cook, okay, or maybe Banks, who's another character we'll get to shortly.
Wonderful character.
Yeah, wonderful character. And so there'd be a line saying that they needed a ship to go to the South Seas. They looked around and they got this one, which was purchased, and it was repurposed and fitted out, and they called it Endeavour, and they gave it this new name. Previously, they said it used to be a coal vessel in the coastal trade. And it was at that moment that the explanation kind of stopped. And you, as writers, know this, that where your curiosity is really piqued, you've got to kind of follow.
To find out.
Yeah. And so I suppose it was that elemental interest in shifting identities, like a David Bowie kind of reinvention. How can this thing, which go carrying
which was
coal,
hunky-dory, become Ziggy Stardust?
Exactly.
And then move on to Aladdin Sane.
Yeah. And this actually happened quite a lot with ships. They did move through different identities. They took on different names. They were assigned to different kind of roles. And this one in particular, I thought, was interesting because, okay, there's a prequel here in a way to the exploration voyage. And what made the story really exciting is there was a sequel to the exploration
story. And
that
was also not known.
Which is not known really at all. So, I mean, specialist academics, and there are people who are working on this now, we'll get to this part of the story later on as well, we'll say. But really, this is the thing. So you have one object which has three different names, goes through these three different identities in three different areas or theatres of history, if you like. And there was, I mean, when I started writing a few big books at the time, one of them was Edmond Duval's Hair with the Amber Eyes, which was the story of Natsuke, some of you might know. So object
gorgeous,
history.
Gorgeous book.
And then there was this book, which the British Museum had brought out, and it was The History of the World in 100 Objects.
You might all know Neil McGregor.
Hugely successful book.
But also just talismanic objects that you can touch, and they're kind of portals or portals.
Yeah, exactly. So this whole idea of like the tactile nature of an object, and you could, you know, it's just like the touching of something. And I remember reading Richard Holmes, a great biographer, writing about Shelley's guitar, for example, years ago.
One of the great writers again.
Yeah. And it was this idea that if you had the object, then the object takes you into the history. And I thought, well, rather, let's kind of invert the British Museum thing. Rather than having the history of the world in 100 objects, what about one object with 100 worlds inside it?
But that's, I mean, it's such a superb and pure, it's kind of a pure idea. And it's also a laser-like focus. So, I mean, you mentioned the acorn. Tell me.
Let's start with the acorn.
The bloody acorns. Right, okay. Yeah. So,
Yorkshire coast.
I have to say.
The moors, the wind sweeping down from the kind of moors.
And all right, Heathcliff.
The crashing. And the crashing waves against the Whitby.
Let me take you back to 2016 when I was, might remember the whole country was convulsed by Brexit. During that really epochal moment for our country when everything was changing, I was looking for the position of some acorns in a forest in Yorkshire. Yeah. That's what I was really obsessed by. And I have to say, I mean, you've been very kind about the book, and I'm really grateful for that. That's not everyone loves the book, because some people read the bit on acorns and say, what the hell is this all about? Because I did go
acordist.
To they're not fancying the acorn part of the history. But I thought, well, you know, if you're going to do
a better line than that. If you're nuts. I mean, they're nuts. I mean, no, it's okay. Go on, carry on. Yeah.
Nazis.
Okay. So if my idea was to tell a, not a cradle to grave biography, but a kind of acorn to seabed biography, I thought I have to start off with these acorns. Okay. Where do they come from? So the ship was comprised of 80 or 90% oak timber. Okay. And this was an interesting idea in itself, because you have like, you know, the character of the wood, different oaks produce different characters. And then, you know, there's so much, if anyone's read, say, Patrick O'Brien or those kind of sea stories, and they talk a lot about the characters of ships, they sometimes will work in different ways. You'll get hard ships, you'll get soft ships, you'll get, you know, all sorts of different things. And nowadays we live in
the way they cut through the water.
But just think about it. In the way that we live in an age of standardization now, where things are so similar, you know, one is the same to the next. And actually with ships, they weren't. And one of the big moments in Endeavour's life is when she collides with the Great Barrier Reef. Now, we'll get back to this later on.
You're doing a Dalrymple. What are you doing?
But this is important.
Very pro-Dalrymple.
Oh, my goodness.
We should give the story away.
This is important. Yeah. But at this point, so the ship is balanced in this hugely perilous moment for about 23 hours. What oak timbers it was made from really matter, because if it was made out of wood that was flawed or weak, the history of the world might have been quite different.
Just don't tell that story yet, because we're getting to that story. But previously on this conversation, you were scrabbling around on the eve of Brexit looking for acorns. Yeah. And how did you manage to, I suppose, assure yourself that you were in the right patch for the right trees, for the right acorns that might have given birth to this ship?
Well, the answer is that I couldn't be sure in the end because the records don't exist. They may not have existed to begin with. It was a very informal trade. The man who built the Earl of Pembroke, which was the first name for the ship, did not leave any certain trace. But I did want to look into this as far as I could because, well, for the reasons that I just told you then. And also, there was this, you know, this kind of national panic at the time in the 18th century, this idea that Britain was being deforested, okay, that the old medieval oaks were vanishing, that something was gone. It was like an early sense of environmental panic.
So right then, people were saying, this is not our land.
The 18th century is often seen as a kind of blithe and bucolic century. Actually, yeah. It was a century of almost incessant warfare. There was a lot of ships timber that was needed for building all of these ships, and a lot of forest.
The British Navy at its peak.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the old chases and hearths and woods and forests were disappearing within the portion of people's lifetime. And this generated a very early sense of environmentalism. Mm. You know, like the environmental movement can probably be traced back to this moment where, you know, people think of the sylvan beauty of medieval England and Robin Hood and his merry men in among the oak trees. And like parish oaks, for example, every parish might have its own distinct oak, and that would have
Charles II sheltering in
the oak. Exactly. And that's actually an important story. All the royal oak pubs that were made after that, which were almost providential idea, that at this moment of great national trauma, like an oak lent a benevolent helping hand.
Yes, you can still shelter under.
And then,
the
of course, you had Oak Apple Day and things like this. And so I worked out that, you know, you read the literature, you find out pretty quickly that for oak timber to be used in ships, it had to be at least 100 years old, because that's the point when it becomes, I mean, it's just sufficient. And it continues in that period for another 100 years before it begins to degrade. So you've got a window of time.
But you're talking about mighty trees that people have loved, and not just they've become used to, but their fathers knew, their grandfathers knew, you know. So these are sort of the heartbeat of what it is to be Britain and British, you know, the oak came to represent
more
that.
More locally than what so, used to be part of your village.
Precisely. So, okay, so we don't know which acorn, but we know roughly where the acorn came from. Tell us about, you know, the timber that was taken and who starts to fashion it into a ship.
I'll tell you quickly, I think I know where the acorns came from. And it is the site of a goape nowadays in North Yorkshire.
Goape, for those who don't know, it's I've taken my boys there. Mm. I've done it. I had to go. My little one was a bit scared. But these are zip wires between treetops. And you climb up to the top and you have to wear a harness and you just basically fling yourself to what feels like almost certain death. Yeah. Children love it. Yeah. They just love it.
Well, if you want to know my reasoning, there's loads of that in the book. But they eventually came to Whitby.
And please, a portrait of Whitby. I went to school in Yorkshire and it was always one of my favourite destinations. You come across the moors.
Yeah.
And there is the Abbey, St Hilda. Caveman, the cowman making his poetry and songs in the shed. Dracula coming ashore there a bit after this.
Yeah, I think Whitby, anyone who goes, I just remember, I think A.A. Gill's last column for the Sunday Times was his favourite restaurant in England, and he chose fish and chips in Whitby. So today it's very much known as that. Whitby is a very small place in a sense, very isolated. So the moors kind of come all
right
the way
up
right up to it. And then it's there, right on the kind of northern coast of North Yorkshire, facing out towards Scandinavia.
Windswept.
Yeah, exactly. And so in a way, because the terrain is so, you know, kind of demanding to cross, it had a distinct regional identity of its own. In a way, it was sometimes more connected to places like Norway, you could make an argument.
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't. But there was the sea paths were easier to cross than getting to the markets of Pickering or down to the society at York.
It had its own intellectual life too. There was very early on a Whitby Philosophical Society.
Yeah, exactly.
And you go there, and there's this wonderful museum with all the Ammonites from the cliffs nearby.
Yeah, and there's the alligator. And it's one of these places where, I mean, it really is Cabinet of Curiosity place where they have the glass Victorian cabinets and there's a hand of glory there and things like this. It's still worth going to today, absolutely. I think the idea that it was a spiritual place, a bit like Lindisfarne as well, it had that, you know, monastic community there. But one thing that was really good about Whitby is it was a haven for ships in storms, and around that built up this port, which was, you know, really important. It became a kind of service station on that eastern coast between the coal collieries of Newcastle, where the coal came down, come down the eastern coast to the markets in London. So you think of all the growth in London.
When I was studying all the Scots going out to India, it's very interesting. None of them go by road. We all think, you know, you get on the train or go on the A1 or whatever. Yeah. You don't. None of that was there.
No.
And so what you did was you got a ship in Leith.
Yeah.
And you went down, stopped at Whitby and went on, or Newcastle, and went into London.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. So yeah. My mother's family come from just a little bit south of Whitby in a place called Filey. And I remember standing on that beautiful beach, which was Catherine Bronte's favourite beach. It's beautiful.
Rambo writes a poem about Promontoire.
Oh, really? Yeah. But just like looking into that eastern horizon and seeing how it's kind of this weird diffuse North Sea light, but how empty it was, and imagining what it was like back in
with all of these masts,
with all these ships just going
past.
I know
exactly.
Like
what
a constant
mean.
Train.
Yeah, of, I mean, like busy and loud and smelly, yeah. And you know, just vibrant.
Carrying all these Dalrymples from Scotland.
Oh God, we'll come to them in a minute, no doubt. But can we talk about, you know, so the great oak is felled. Do we know roughly the year that it would have been?
Yeah, some things we know actually, yeah, in quite good detail. So the first builder was a man called Thomas Fishburne,
yeah,
who was a very, very competent, upwardly mobile shipwright. Shipwright wasn't a very high status profession, but it was one where you could actually become quite wealthy. So it was like a blue collar job, we might call it today. But he'd kind of built himself out of nothing. And Fishburne's ships were really good, solid things. Cook would always sail in Fishburne ships to the South Seas. So this is the maths I worked on. So we know that Endeavour, which was the Earl of Pembroke really at this point, was launched in the summer of 1764. So the oaks that built her were acorns 100 years ago at the time of the Restoration. So that's kind of that bit of history. And the process of building would have taken a few months at least, but it wouldn't have been notable. It was the kind of thing that was happening continuously at Whitby, which was a shipbuilding.
So Fishburne is kind of the man people go to for good ships. He's kind of, you know, the Henry Ford of ships that work,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But then tell me a bit about Thomas Milner, who is really interesting character who's quite important in the early days of Endeavour.
Yeah, well, he's the first master. So again, we're in this community of Whitby ship owners and ship builders, and this is Milner's world, really. So he is someone who leaves a very faint trace in the records. You can see his lists of ships, but we don't know anything about him. He's just a kind of hologrammatic character. I mean, he you know, he's the master, which would be the person in command. This is in a merchant vessel. This is the person at the top. And he would sail with maybe 8 or 9 kind of people with him on these colliers, they were called, as a catch-all term. And he'd been doing this for years and years and years. So he was quite old by this point. And one of the best, so there's a few things that I can tell you about Milner, which are interesting. And both of them are by processes of deduction. First of all, he never had any significant accident. And that was what,
that's a big deal.
Which is a really
an
big deal.
An accident on the high seas is not great.
But yeah, his job, it was a really dangerous job, yeah, to go down through all of those shoals off like East Anglia. And he never had any significant problem. If his job was to take coal to London and bring the ships back again, he did it time and time and time again. The other thing I found about him, which was really fascinating for me, is that he was illiterate. And we know this because in, I think, Whitby Museum, they had an acknowledgement of a loan that he was acknowledging. And beneath this, it had an M for Milner. And beneath that was just a cross and it said Mark. So once we know that he's illiterate, you can kind of build a bit of a wider biography.
Where he might have come from.
Because he was not educated.
But you know, the fact, I mean, you do say in your book that, you know, the fact that he has this extraordinary record of not having disasters, because it's quite hard, means that he ran a tight ship to sort of, you know, yeah, abuse.
And at this point, Whitby was always described by the Georgians as a nursery of seamen. So this was a place where the best sailors came from. Lots of reasons for this I don't have time to get into today.
Once you've mastered those heavy seas, the North Sea, you can do anything.
Exactly. Well, this is it. So there was these colliers were lightly manned. They were a little bit...
What did they look like? I mean, you're saying Collier, but I want to know what it looked like and how big it was and how many people could go on it. Give me an idea.
Yeah, so let's tell you about the Earl of Pembroke as she was launched. It's like 100 foot long, three masts. So you have your mizzen, your four main and mizzen masts. So they've got the three masts. It's a very tight, confined space. You might think of ships of having various decks which go down. Actually, Colliers were generally hollow. They were built expressly to carry cargo. The largest amount of cargo. Yeah. And so you'd have these kind of small dog hole like areas at the front on the forecastle.
Dog hole.
Yeah.
Like you'd little... too much master commander.
Yeah, sorry, too much master command. But they'd have these
little
about
dog holes.
So, but it was a social space. So it was all quite defined. So as the master, Milner would be, you know, towards the rear on the quarter deck, and you'd have the young sailors would be at the front. And that would be, you know, something that was really important. There'd be a strict hierarchy, an order of command, all these things.
How many people could fit on a ship like that?
So with Endeavour, about 100. Mm-hmm. But if we go back to this point, probably about 10. So you can see...
10 men only to take a ship all the way down.
Yeah, exactly. So you can see why they got very good very quickly, because it was all about economics. So right. the fewer salaries you have to pay, the more cargo that you can carry.
Right.
There's a great... I don't know if you have the ability to do this or whatnot, but there's a Turner seascape which shows these colliers being filled with coal on at Shields on the River Tyne, which is where the coal would come from the mines,
from the
collieries.
The Northumberland and...
Yeah. And they'd load them up there. And there's this kind of moment of exchange where you can see there's money being passed between one and the other. It's a kind of nighttime scene and there's like burning. It's one of Turner's beautiful social pictures, really.
Do you know what we can do? We can put it on our newsletter for club. If you're a club member, you might get to see this.
And down they came to London where they were unloaded.
Okay, so in 1764, she makes her maiden voyage.
Just the boat again. It's broad, round, sturdy and flat-bottomed. And that's important.
Okay. Very important.
What will come. So she's not sleek and beautiful, but she's an incredibly sturdy boat that's built for heavy seas.
Built to last and to need very few repairs. This thing about the flat bottoms are important in this story. Let's get that. Let's
go. Rock and well go round. Anyway, Karen.
it doesn't sound important, but the world was made on flat bottoms.
Don't worry about me.
Just had a pretty moment.
They could be beached for running repairs, so you could repair them on the fly, if you like. And the other thing which was really useful about them is you could take them really close into shore, because if you can imagine that they had these like projecting bottoms, shall we say, they'd be much more difficult to take in close to shore, because you're more in danger of running against reefs and things. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of the surveying work that comes later, these were useful characteristics.
Right, okay. And also what I loved is that dimensions mean very little to most people, but it would take 20 seconds to walk from one end to the other. And that's, you see, in every everybody's imagination, the Endeavour is huge. Captain Cook is huge. Yeah. This is not huge, really.
It feels capacious, doesn't it? It should be.
Cook, in many ways, is the kind of human embodiment of this boat, isn't he? He's also plain, sturdy, and sort of unremarkable outwardly.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. There's a lot of similarities between the two of them.
Okay, I'm going to just focus in on this ship. So 1764 is the maiden voyage, but by 1769, so only 5 years later, this turns from being a coal-hauling pack horse of a ship to being a ship of discovery. How does that rebirth happen?
So the big driving factor, I mean, this is fundamental. So the big catalytic factor, shall I say, is there was going to be a transit of Venus. So for Georgians, this was exciting stuff.
What is a transit of Venus?
We've had one recently. I don't think any of us is going to see one again, because they happen very rarely. Yeah. They happen in pairs, 8 years apart. And
you saw the last one?
No, I'm married to a physicist. So I know about the transit of Venus.
Seen the last one. You can talk more about the transit of Venus later. So there'd been one in 1761.
Yeah.
And there was going to be another one. And behind this transit was a lot of excitable mathematicians. Because if you could gather data from dispersed places on planet Earth and bring all of this faithful data back, it would help them to work out the distance between the Earth and the Sun. There's another book actually by Andrea Wolf.
Oh, Andrea Wolf's brilliant book. Yes, of course.
He's written Chasing Venus, which is, it became really this idea of measuring the transit became a huge international enterprise at a time of war. So even despite the fact there was a war going on between principally Britain and France, there was lots of coordination because they knew that this was
an opportunity. This is important. This is bigger than us.
Yeah, it's like a transcendent thing. It wasn't an opportunity to miss.
Also, her book about Linnaeus, by the way, is brilliant.
So in 1761, things hadn't gone really well because it was a time of conflict. There was lots of poor planning, bad luck. There's stories of, I think, some French observers who'd gone to Siberia with their telescopes and they were suspected to be magicians, so they were chased away and things. So there was a sense that in 1769, when the transit came around again, they really had to catch it this time because they weren't going to get another chance. And one of the places they had to go, really, really vital to get data, was the middle of the South Seas. Problem was, no one knew anything about the South Seas.
Was it a blank on a map? And when we say nobody knew about it, well, I mean, does the map just stop?
It kind of. I describe it as a locked room in a manor house where people don't quite understand what's inside, and it really entices people. You do have occasional voyages across. So so Byron, Captain Byron, who I think is the grandfather of the poet, had gone across, but he went at top speed and didn't
goods
really
passing
stop.
Passing from that area. So, for example, cockatoos are passing out of New Guinea into India and appearing in sort of Renaissance landscape pictures painted in Florence.
But literally, I guess the coastlines are not they're not really.
No, but I think also at this point it's very important to clarify. Yeah. I'm talking from a British Western point of view. There were people who knew. There were
people who had been living there.
And that's a point which sometimes I missed. But getting round Cape Horn was a real big sailing.
He's pointing at the Dalrymple coming up.
I didn't want to be the one to bring this one.
Yeah, that's why he just did that. All right.
Should we go on to Dalrymple in a moment? I'll finish off with the transit thing. So this was the first and most important motive for the voyage. The Royal Society decided that they needed to send a ship to the middle of the Pacific. What's going to happen? And now enter Alexander Dalrymple.
Who he?
Do you mind if I just roll my eyes to the back of my skull? Okay.
I had no idea if Dalrymple would turn up for this story.
Oh, no more Dalrymples. Okay, cool your heels for a second. Join us after the break. We're going to do it. We're going to talk a Dalrymple, one of the great Dalrymples of history. Join us after the break. Welcome back. Yes, it's happening. We've got a Dalrymple in this podcast. Shock.
Go for it, Peter.
All right, Alexander Dalrymple. Who was he and why are we talking about yet another Dalrymple of history?
Well, you're well aware, Anita, the Dalrymples are like the Blackadders of history. They pop up in every generation to consequence.
Where's Wally's?
I'd describe it to my 6-year-old boys like the Minions who kind of they keep popping up.
The better. Okay. Yeah.
So in this particular incarnation, the Dalrymples were represented by Alexander Dalrymple.
Yes.
And there's more you can say here as well to fill in bits that I don't know about very well.
Happy to add some detail.
Listen, Alexander Dalrymple, fascinating character, much maligned in history, because as James Cook's reputation really soared after his death. There was a bit of a fall guy in the story, and the fall guy was Alexander Dalrymple. Right. But early on, let's go back to the mid-1750s.
One of the great tragedies of history.
When you had a Dalrymple who was filled with wanderlust for the East, wanted to go out. Yeah. Wanted to go out to change the world. I think he wanted to expand the knowledge of mankind. And
you're not even original.
And the second part of this was to add to the glory of his home country. I'm not sure.
Exactly. That's always been one of the main motivations.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Alexander Dalrymple, as a very young, I suppose, 18-year-old or so, 16, goes to India. And it's not just any time. These are absolutely crucial years. I know from your book, The Anarchy, you say that of all the countries that were changed by the Seven-Year War, India was the place that was most contorted out of its previous shape. Mm. And Alexander Dalrymple is there throughout all of this history as a very junior member he's growing through the ranks. But he's in Madras, he's working for the East India Company. And his eyes are very much upon the Eastern Islands and the Eastern trade. And now he's thinking that the Dutch have got a monopoly over here. And there's more that the East India Company can be doing to extend British commerce in this direction.
Because the early voyages had really just concentrated on nutmeg and the spice trade in East India.
But I don't think we've really said who he is. Is he an academic, or is he an explorer, or is he a trader? Who was the elder Dalrymple? At this point, he's
young, he's clever, he's full of ambition. He's from a notable Scottish family, so he's got some connections.
Yeah.
But Enlightenment.
Yeah.
Historians as a father and grandfather, yeah. Friends of Samuel Johnson and all that sort of world.
Yeah, I think so. But he does have, he has vision, he has energy, and he has ambition. These are all things which are crucial to the story that unfolds afterwards.
He's working in the cartography department. He's a young cartographer. He's only 18 or something. There's this moment when the East India Company captures Pondicherry. And everyone else is thrilled because it means they defeated the French. What Alexander Dalrymple realizes is that it gives him access now to the French map room. So he takes all the English charts of the South Seas down to the French map room in Pondicherry, and he puts the two charts together, and he realizes that there's a landmass down there that people are hitting and not properly exploring.
So we've got Dalrymple on one side, who says there's this whole unexplored bit, which I want to get my hands on. And you've got the transit of Venus, which is quite separate from that. And the two interests collide,
Absolutely.
They,
so this
at
is
the Royal
this is
Society
a-
Club dinner in Fleet Street.
Yeah, so really...
1768, 7th of January.
Mid-1760s, Dalrymple comes back from India.
Yeah.
He's in London. He makes friends with people like Benjamin Franklin, very important figure.
Yes, of course,
figures.
He's flying his kites,
yeah,
isn't he?
No, yeah. You can tell you much about Franklin another day, but he's there. And what they see is a very, very unusual character who has a huge knowledge of the East, which actually, you know, is still very sketchy in Britain, who has got an idea for a project. This is the age of big projects. And he says, well, you know what? He'd actually been on East India voyages out into the East to various different islands. He'd got some experience of dealing with what in the period term were called native populations. Mm. I know that's a bit of a loaded term now. But in many ways, he's a really good candidate to take this transit voyage to the East Indies.
To the point where somebody like Adam Smith gets really enthused by the project.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Adam Smith, economist that is much quoted. Well, does he put money as well as support behind this?
I think it's more his support. I don't think he needs... The money becomes a problem.
Adam Smith's from Fife.
Yeah.
And Dalrymple's from Edinburgh. So they're neighbours. They're sort of...
Are they
other
rivals?
Side,
I mean,
other
but he's
side.
Quite
I think
supportive.
Sort of, they're very much on the same sort of side. Okay. Although Adam Smith doesn't like the East India Company.
No, but he likes it. But he likes this idea of, you know, exploration and expansion. And the possibilities.
Yeah, I think also you have to see him as a context of like the Act of Union. He's a young Scot in London, and he's also treated with a little bit of suspicion.
How old is Adam Smith? Because we always think of the venerable old economist, but how old is he?
It's a long time before. I mean, Wealth of Nations came out in 1776.
Okay.
It's when he was probably in his more lecturing phase, when he was gathering information. So he's not, you know,
he's not the old Smith of legend.
Yet.
No, not the one that was
on
paper.
He's two young Scotsmen on the make.
Yeah, and the Scottish had big influence at this point in the world of politics, business and law.
Sure.
You can find lots of Scottish figures in here. And so Dalrymple was, I think, positioning himself within that milieu, if you want to use that term. He was living in Soho Square, which is, you know, good place to live, good neighbours. And
he's hanging out at the Royal Institution.
Yeah, he's
where all the most excellent and clever people.
And what you needed at that time was interest, and he had interest. He had a vision, and he had interest. And throughout the early portion of 1768, you have ideas for the transit going forward. You have Dalrymple lobbying hard to take the ship. Dalrymple's particular interest is in something which he calls the Great Southern Continent. Mm. So rather than being a kind of airy idea of going to various islands, this is the Enlightenment, we have to remember. Mm. And on good, solid, rational, mathematical Enlightenment principles,
ideas,
there was an idea of counterpoise. Mm. So the same land mass had to exist in the southern hemisphere as in the north.
Otherwise,
the world would be out. This is another thing to talk to physicists about.
He saw these stray sightings that he'd seen on these maps, one Dutch voyage going this direction, another Spanish voyage going another, and a French one. And he thought, put them all together and guessed correctly. correctly that there was a continent there, and but thought it was the wrong, thought exactly. It was far bigger than
right,
it actually
okay,
was.
Okay.
And in the plainest terms, I think he saw himself as a second Columbus, because he was going to be the person to
his
stand on.
Dalrymple's never underestimated in my experience.
So this is the story of early 1768.
Okay, all right. So you've got this whippersnapper, Dalrymple, who thinks he knows a lot. But now he's got to put money where his mouth is, basically.
And he's got to raise money.
Yeah. I mean, the budget is about £4,000. How does that equate to today's money? Do you have any idea how much that expedition would cost today?
I mean, so a gentleman in Pall Mall would have £6,000 a year, I suppose. It'd be
so
like
how would you work?
I always find financial comparisons really, really difficult, because things are so distorted with the past. But let's say
it's just slightly shy of a rich man's annual salary, but he needs to get the money, and as William just blew it, the king gives it. I mean, what is it hard to raise the money? Is that where the king gives it?
As ever with these things in history, there's a bit of a curveball. I think the Royal Society don't have enough money because the accounts haven't been kept well enough. So what they have to do is appeal to the king. So we've got this really important transit coming up. It would be of great benefit to your regal
because it's
honor.
A race, as you say. The French are after it. Everyone's trying to go.
The Russians might be going. So this is the kind of thing which elicits royal support.
Right.
And with the royal support and the royal money, which comes duly, is the involvement of the Royal Navy, the Admiralty get involved.
Okay.
So you can see here what I've described, everything I've described now becomes this great blancmange of motive and ownership, because you've got the Royal Society and the Admiralty working together. Those are two separate management strands.
And then young things like Adam Smith and stuff saying, this is a really good idea. So you've got the little buzz going on.
Yeah, you've got that. And you've got the kind of confused motive. Are they going to...
Are they mapping or are they transit of Venusing?
Is it a voyage of curiosity or is it a voyage of imperial expansion?
Sure.
Or is it how far as an intellectual voyage, studying astronomy and studying the geography of the size deals, how far does that intellectual curiosity extend?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so the money then, the Royal Society doesn't have the cash, but they have the influence. So the king says, I shall give you £4,000. And the money is there. When does that money connect with the ship we now know as Endeavour?
Yeah, so this is early March. So
early
we get to
March, are we talking, what, 1768?
This is the crucial month, really. And what I do in the book is try and go through all the documentary evidence which is behind this transformation, which begins at this point. So you can imagine what happens is basically Milner in the Earl of Pembroke is just tootling along in his collier, comes into the Thames. Someone from the Admiralty is on the lookout for, you know, a boat or a bark, I should call it at this point, of about the right dimensions, about the right price, which can stow a large amount of materials for a voyage around the world.
And that preferably hasn't had an accident. And Milner is really quite distinctive because he's never had a bump.
So Milner has exactly. He has this great stroke of fortune, really, because he manages to make a big profit because he could sell to an interested buyer. At this point, the Earl of Pembroke is, 4 years old, little shy of 4 years old. So it's in good condition. Some of these collies would go for 100 years. They were that well built.
Really? Wow.
So it's a kind of baby in those
nearly
terms.
New.
Yeah, that's probably, I'm trying to think of what it would be on
pre-loved.
eBay. It would be almost
pre-loved.
Yeah,
pre-loved. Only recently pre-loved.
It's bought by the Navy. Now, Dalrymple's important here because Dalrymple later claims many times that he was the one who selected, because there was a choice. There was like, you can have that one, you can have that one, or you can have that one. Dalrymple says, we're going to have that one because it can take an extra anchor.
With the Earl of Pembroke.
And he makes this claim publicly, with the Earl of Pembroke.
Okay.
So, and I've always, I spent a lot of time trying to work out who came up with the name Endeavour as well, because it's a great name. It's full of vim, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it might have been Dalrymple as well who gave that name Endeavour.
The other candidate
is Admiral Hawke.
So there's a bus.
We've not mentioned Cook.
Cook is nothing to do with this. Cook is just the Yorkshireman running the coal ship.
So all of this, so Dalrymple possibly says, I want you, takes the Earl of Pembroke, and then arguably says, I'm going to give you a thrusting name like Endeavour, arguably. And then...
Well, you see, it was a quite uncompromising character, William Dalrymple, Alexander Dalrymple. I don't know if you want to.
Just laughing. Yes.
Half intentional. Yeah. No, the thing was a question of command. Who is going to be in command of this?
And we've never had that issue, have we?
Dalrymple says that. I will go on this, and it will be under my command and my command only. And
I think.
I don't know how many buttons I'm touching here with this, with this parochial history story of mine.
You'll settle down any second now. Okay. He tires himself out. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. So history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme, they say. So he's got a clear vision that he's going to be the Columbus, as we pointed out. Mm. But I think by this point, the Royal Society would have been happy with that. The Admiralty find the idea repugnant. That a landsman who's not part of the Royal Navy is going to command a Royal Navy ship with a Royal Navy tower.
Between the East India Company and the Admiralty. Right.
Of this kind of explodes. And there's a particular council meeting of the Royal Society where Dalrymple's informed that he is not going to have command. And
he's
only
going to have the scientific end of the
explosion. Yeah, and at which point he quits.
One
of the great disasters of world history.
I mean, in a teenage peak, because he's a teenager still.
So having, in his view, outlined the parameters of the voyage. Exits the story very, very abruptly.
Wow.
In a terrific bad temper. So when the story's often told, the story begins with this temper tantrum of a toddler Dalrymple. This is how the traditional story, and he's cast in those light. It's not a great light to be shown in, but I have to say
misrepresented family.
Familiar with the
in Dalrymple's defense, he's quite magnanimous actually. He gives a copy of his unpublished manuscript for the voyages into the East, which has all the information that you were talking about before. He just gives it over.
He just hands it over.
Yeah.
To Captain Cook, who then becomes household name forever and ever and ever.
Don't just Captain Cook it like this. And breathe. So in all this time where Dalrymple is doing all this really quite extraordinary stuff, you know, amazing actually for somebody this young to get, you know, the momentum and the money and everything else and the ship and the name maybe. Who's Cook? Is Cook? And where is Cook?
I kind of point out in the book that, you know, at the start of March, they had Dalrymple and no ship. So they had to find a ship and they had the commander. By the end of the month, they had the ship, but they didn't have the commander. So it was like they were thrown from the horns of one dilemma to another. And basically, they had to look around and find who was available. And who was available, this is one of the lucky strikes in Royal Naval history.
Depends how you look at it.
Exactly. But for the Royal Navy in particular, Cook was there. You know, he was serving.
What was his track record and how old was he? Give us an idea.
He'd grown up in the collier trade. He then joined the Royal Navy as a, kind of an ordinary seaman. And for probably 10 years, I can't tell you precisely, he'd served in various lowly positions. He'd become a master.
But he knew these ships. If he was working in colliers, he knew this.
Well,
there's
a kind of thing about Cook when he said, he's once asked why he left the collier trade, and he says, I want to go and seek my fortune. And the really weird thing about Cook is that his fortune turns out to be a Whitby collier ship waiting for him. So it's like a rejoining.
No
He'd been doing things like he was at the Battle of Quebec, for example. He'd surveyed the St. Lawrence before that famous moment with Wolfe. And then later on, he'd been out in Newfoundland.
Both of them were surveyors, weren't they?
Yeah.
Both of them knew how to do a map.
So this hydrographer, it's a kind of new type of person. It wasn't just a good sailor. He was a new kind of scientific character. He knew how to use. He'd like have a new iPhone
the title
if he was around.
Alexander Dalrymple's visiting card. He was hydrographer.
Yeah, exactly.
So he had instruments. So he knew. He measured things. So he recorded things. Yeah. And, you know.
But I think by this point he had a reputation for supreme competence. He could do things.
So the Royal Navy says, right, okay, Dalrymple's flounced off in a mood. So what we're going to do?
Why are you looking so pleased with that?
So we'll find another chap, this guy, Cook. Yep. Let's find Cook. Yep. So Cook immediately accepts this and is given the Endeavour as his ship.
And Cook is the opposite of Dalrymple in that he doesn't have tantrums.
He's cool as a cucumber.
Completely steady.
Mm. Yeah.
Doesn't know any of this scientific stuff, he is completely 100% reliable, which is why then they have to bring in another scientist who is...
Well, Joseph Banks, right. Okay, so Banks really fixes...
Just before you get to Banks, just talking about Cook's personality and being the anti-Dalrymple, you know, emotional, cries at the drop of a hat. this is a pen portrait of Cook from his biographer, J.C. Beaglehole?
Beaglehole, yeah, sorry. Name.
Fantastic name, Beaglehole. The genius of Cook was not in the ordinary sense creative, nor was it precocious. There was nothing aesthetic, nothing of brilliance about him. He would have been startled by the idea that anything he did might touch the emotions. His energy of mind was that of a mature kind, that is, on the intellectual side, critical, a sort of analytical and detective energy on the practical and constructive side. It was the energy of planning, of administration, and of foresight. He sounds quite dull to be with, to be honest. I mean, I'd rather hang out with Dalrymple, to be honest.
No, you'd actually prefer to hang out with Joseph
Banks.
Joseph
Banks, we have to say, okay, is a classic Anita pinup.
All right, yeah. Come on.
He is Fred from Accounts or whatever.
Fabio from Accounts. Just created this image of me, but I'll go with it. Tell me about Banks. What did he look like? Was he dreamy?
Think of a young David Attenborough, but like 1951, kind of scampering around. I mean, he had the absolutely gold star education. He went to Harrow and Eton, then Christ College, Oxford. I mean, he was a Lincolnshire gentry family, lots of money, and
charming, good looking.
But and Banks had this mania for botany, which was the kind of sexy science of the day. After Linnaeus was really transformed this idea of botany into something that was, you know, really revolutionary and exciting. So it was a great process of classification going on. And Banks, they often say, if you want to understand someone, look at what the world was like when they were 20 years old. And when Banks was 20, botany was just the thing. And you could, you know, you could botanize wherever. But the real draw for Banks was finding new stuff to expand knowledge. And so he'd already gone across to North America, Newfoundland again, I think, on one of his botanical expeditions. And this one is a great phrase from Banks where he says...
Look up his face, by the way, while you're talking.
Yeah, but
great disappointed.
The great quote from Banks is like, he says, any blockhead can do a grand tour. My grand tour shall be one round the whole world. You know, so he's so he's full of a kind of intent and action.
I see what you mean. And he's, okay, all right. So he's charming, he's clever, he's directed.
And you've written enigmatic, complex, driven.
Okay, well, there we go.
You got to tell the frog story, my favourite story in your book.
Oh, yes, the frog story is a good story.
Well, he had this thing, as I say, he was into interacting with nature, something that he got from his mother, who taught him very early on that nature was something to be embraced and interacted with and so on. And one of the great contemporary fears in nature was the dangerous, venomous nature of frogs and toads and things like this. And with a party of friends, Banks had stumbled across some frog, I think, which he demonstrated that was completely placid by picking up. And so the story goes, it jumped into Banks's mouth as he was explaining. and this became one of these anecdotes. But one which I think tells you a little bit about, like, Banks wasn't too perturbed. A lot of people,
no,
a lot of Georgians.
No, but that's very Attenborough, isn't it? Oh, whoops.
Yeah. And so I know, actually, even today, David Attenborough talks about Joseph Banks being one of his great heroes. Yeah. And when they had an exhibition at the British Library a few years ago, David Attenborough opened that up. I should also say, out of the two, you know, like Cook and Banks, Banks was the more imperialistic of the two, I'd say. He was the one who thought less about indigenous populations, for example. Okay. He was on a drive to find knowledge.
So he had that narrow field of vision that sometimes scientists do have. Can I read a thing about him as well, which I really liked? Banks's journal shows a man who set to his collecting every morning with the cheer and spring of a pastor on Easter Sunday, which is kind of this evangelicism about, you know, what he was doing, blind to everything else.
And his journal, the Voyaging Journal, Banks's Endeavour Voyaging Journal, is the great, I think, Enlightenment document, because it's full of movement, it's full of observation, it's completely empirical, it's quite funny in times. Banks has got this ability that to, I mean, he doesn't have any kind of introspective reflections that you might get in a 21st century memoir? So when people thinking about their emotional health and state
well,
and things
not,
like
that. That's not how scientists
That's not how role. Banks works. Yeah. He looks outwards. He sees things. Yeah. He classifies them. And he's like he's got this Labradorish excitement. So everywhere he goes.
He's a Labrador, exactly.
Yeah, he is a Labrador, yeah.
Well, look, okay, so we've got the Labrador. We've got Banks.
And no Dalrymple.
We haven't got the Scots Terrier. Dalrymple splashed off in a yappy half. We've got Cook, who would be, I don't know, the Basset Hound, quite sort of dour, sad. Mm. But the stage is set. And join us for the next episode of this epic Three Ships. Thank God you knew the Christmas Carol. On Thursday, unless, of course, you're a member of the club, in which case you can just click on it right now and it's available. Well, how do they do that if they're not?
Just sign up at empirepoduk.com, where you can also get Peter's wonderful book for a discount.
So till then, it's goodbye from me, Anita Arnon.
Goodbye from me, William Dalrymple.